I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
And John, here we are again on a Saturday morning recording another podcast. I have finished a second cup of coffee.
So you're ready to go. We're ready to do this. Thank you.
I'm either ready to go or I'm ready to go.
Yeah. Nice. This is the first time in the history of our podcast where we have two Patricks on at the same time. Today we are joined by Patrick Loyer. He's a writer and he's had book reviews and essays that have appeared in African American Review, the Harvard Review, the Georgia Review, Globe and Mail, and Boing Boing, amongst other publications. And today he's here to tell us a little bit about False Idols, which is an audio program from our friends at Cereal Box. So Patrick Loyer, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Thank you, Patrick, for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Right off the bat, let's get into False Idols. Can you tell us how that project came about and what it's about?
So False Idols is a bit of a curveball for me. That the project came about for me a bit circuitously. My agent's former assistant, Matt Wise, who's out in California. He works with Adaptive Studios. He reached out to me in spring of 2016 and asked me if I'd be interested in basically in this project, this project for Cereal Box, which is a partner of Adaptive Studios. Cereal Box is based in New York. And Cereal Box's business model is essentially producing books, but using kind of like a TV production model. So the Cereal Box produces books collaborative teams of writers with a lead writer. And that way they're able to basically make books really quickly. At least a few years on average for a writer to write a book on their own, but using this co-authored or collaborative model, Cereal Box is able to basically produce books in about half a year or a little more than that. So I was intrigued when Matt gave me this opportunity. I said yes. And then about maybe 5 or 6 months later, I was invited out to LA to the Adaptive Studios offices, where I met my co-authors. I met the lead writer, whose name is Lisa Klink, and I met Diana Wren, who's an author based outside of Boston, Massachusetts. And for about 3 days in that Culver City, California office, we basically held a writer's room. We covered the walls with post-its, with notes, and we brainstormed this novel, an 11-episode novel based on, I think it was like a 5 or 6 page story Bible that Lisa had developed with some of the team at Cereal Box and Adaptive. So we fleshed that out on the walls together over these very intense days. And then we each went our separate ways. And then a couple months after that, in early 2017, we started each writing our respective episodes or chapters of the book. So I think basically the whole thing, all of 2017 was just this intense collaborative, project, just working together, lots of telecons, lots of Dropbox, lots of Google Docs, lots of emails, and just lots of brainstorming and figuring out, how do we keep how do we keep this energy of this story? And the story is a thriller. It's a thriller based in this sort of high stakes world of art theft. So it's about a new or a very young FBI agent named Layla Aldeeb, who is of Egyptian descent. She was born in Cairo, born in a very poor family in Cairo, and she was left her family to go to college in the U.S. Under very sort of emotionally painful circumstances. She's got this great facility with languages. So she's a translator with the FBI and she's multilingual. And sort of essentially it's about her connecting with the head of the art crimes unit in the FBI. She is recruited to go undercover for an operation that has extremely critical national security implications. And I don't want to go too much more into it because I don't want to spoil it for anyone who's going to read it.
Any Clapton fans in the writer's room?
I don't know. I'm not sure if there are Clapton fans. I am not sure if Lisa or Diana are Clapton fans.
Okay.
I am not. I must admit I am not. Why do you ask?
Because of the song Layla.
Oh.
Which was about his love of George Harrison's wife, Patty, and eventual, like, he actually won her over and she left George Harrison and married him.
I know that story. I do know that story. That's interesting. No, I don't know. I actually don't know what the inspiration for the name was. It was in a story Bible, so I don't know. I'd have to ask Lisa what the inspiration for Layla was.
I was just curious.
Nice. Patrick, you know, you'd mentioned sort of the kind of television writer's model. We've had a few folks from various Serial Box productions on the show before, and they all seem to have a very positive take on that kind of writer's room. And was that a new, different experience for you? And how would you say your experience was with it?
Yeah, it was completely new for me, and it was very positive. When Matt first sort of floated the idea and described that model, I was a little bit confused, didn't exactly know what to make of it. I've never written for television or for film, but I was intrigued. And I think, I think one of the things is, as a writer, you're used to sitting alone for hours, days, weeks, months, years. So any opportunity to kind of break out of that solitude, maybe hang out with other human beings is kind of welcome. So in that way, it was very intriguing. And then I think I guess I lucked out, and I gather that the other Serial Box writers that you've spoken to have lucked out, because my team was great. You know, I Lisa and Diana are awesome. They have more professional experience than I do. Lisa comes from the world of television writing. She's LA based, so she's actually from that whole kind of Deep Space Nine and Voyager world. So she's like a veteran of that world. So she had a lot of experience and was able to lead us really effectively in terms of, you know, making sure that we collaborated well, and that we definitely try to have like a bit of a cliffhanger for just about every episode. Diana lives outside of Boston, and she's a young adult author, and she's written about three different books. So she's got, you know, a lot of experience and just expertise with pacing, with characterization, a lot of insights with research. I think two of her books have actually even touched on some of the themes that False Idols touches on when it comes to art crimes and art theft. So I learned a tremendous amount from Lisa and Diana. I learned a lot about, basically just, I learned a lot from their styles. I learned a lot from their approaches. I learned a lot about the whole process from the teams at both Cereal Box and at Adaptive. We had great editors, Molly Barton, and Lydia Shama are some of the people at Cereal Box that we worked with very closely. My editor at Adaptive, Matt Wise, was awesome. So you know, there was just a lot of great energy and a really great team. And so overall, it was a tremendous experience. Very intense, but extremely positive and a real learning experience for me.
That's fantastic. And that's kind of the feedback that we've gotten from other people. I think, as you said, writing could be a lonely, isolating experience. So I think if you get in a room with really good creative collaborators, it's usually a positive thing. So that's where I'm glad to hear that was your experience as well.
Oh yeah.
Cool. You know, before we get on to our next section, I want to thank our listeners who are backing us. We have a Patreon page. It's patreon.com/functionalnerds. And many of our listeners back us over there at a couple bucks a month. And it helps us invest in the show and get great guests like Patrick Lohier here. And if you enjoy these episodes and get some value out of the show and you want to support us, again, go over to patreon.com/functionalnerds and choose a level that works for you, and we greatly appreciate it. Now let's get on to our picks of the week.
And before we get into those picks of the week, John, our friend Gail Carriger has a new podcast called 20 Minute Delay that she wants to tell all of our listeners about. Take it away, Gail.
I'm Gail Carriger, and I travel a lot, or I thought I did until I met Piper, who travels more than I do. And we are both super travel dorks. So we thought, let's get together and talk about travel hacks, tips, tricks, and horror stories. Check us out on 20 Minute Delay, a new podcast about travel.
Picks of the week.
And Patrick Lohier, why don't you go first with your pick of the week?
So my pick of the week is I'll actually pick, it's a whole trilogy. So I don't know if anyone on your show recently has mentioned any of Jeff Vandermeer's books. Have they?
Not recently, but yeah, we've had Jeff on the show before.
And, awesome.
Yeah, and I know some people at some point have. So yeah, go for it.
So I'm in the second book of his Southern Reach trilogy. I'm reading Authority now. So the first book is Annihilation, which I gather is coming out as a movie soon. So it's very bizarre. You know, it's like fiction of the weird, it's quite captivating and mysterious. It just deals with this zone in northern Florida, off the coast of Florida, that has been sealed off. It's a bit of a challenge to figure out if it's now, the future. I think it's more kind of contemporary, but it's basically, it's been sealed off by the government, and the interior of this zone called Area X is just a bizarre kind of natural wilderness. It's this wilderness where something has clearly gone wrong. The animals look and act weird. The vegetation is very strange. Anyone who enters this zone, I think, feels strange, and it seems that they act oddly. And the first book, Annihilation, is about a one of many expeditions into the zone, one of many government sent expeditions into the zone. And the second book, Authority, which I'm halfway through, is about a bureaucrat, a government bureaucrat who's sent in to help administer the zone. So it's almost like so far a book of office politics, but under the most bizarre circumstances, because their job is to find out what the hell happened in this zone off of Florida, and there seems to be a threat. You know, there seems to be an existential threat to humanity and to the Earth that seems localized in this zone. So this guy whose name is Control is just trying to figure out what is going on with this region. And even his colleagues are kind of weird people. So a bit of Lovecraft, a bit of, alien. I don't know. It's just like a mishmash of different tropes that I find quite captivating and really amazing.
Excellent. I did read an article recently about the movie that's coming out, and that I think it was a situation or is a situation where either the director or one of the producers has sort of final say on the cut. And I think it was a thing where the studio heads wanted to edit it to make it more sort of viewer friendly, I guess. And because it is, you know, from what I understand, a pretty weird book. And the producer or director really held his ground. He's like, no, this is what I want. This is what I want it to be. I want it to be this vision. And it's going to hurt them a little bit, because I think it's going to hurt their distribution. Because I think more internationally than anything else, I think it's going to be limited in its release, because I guess the studio feels like it's too weird to really go out there and promote, especially internationally. So it's some interesting articles out there about that one, if you're into sort of the movie business side of it. Patrick, I know you're biting your tongue. Patrick Hester, I know, is biting his tongue over there. I know he has feelings about
this. This is one of those situations where I actually had high hopes for the movie, changing it to make it actually palatable and something that people can enjoy.
Well, then that could still be the case. I don't know what the issues are.
Yeah, to me, it's an unreadable book.
Yeah, I know. Patrick Hester did not like this book. So as soon as Patrick laid it, I'm like, this is funny, because I think we need to talk about this on a recent episode. Hey, man, that's what's great about
Patrick. This is the book that both launched and destroyed the SF Signal podcast book club.
Interesting. Yeah.
Because I read it over a weekend, and I'm sitting there going, did they not edit this? Was there no editor?
Did you read Authority and Acceptance?
No. No. Yeah. And it's funny. First of all, Jeff, I consider Jeff a friend. He's been on podcasts. He took this very, very personally, my dislike of this book.
Oof.
So, and Jeff, I do apologize, but I am allowed to like or dislike a book. I am also allowed to talk about publicly whether I like or dislike a book. And yeah, during that podcast, I sat there very quietly and let everybody rave about how great that book was. And I thought I got away with it and wasn't going to have to say a damn word until someone said, "Well, Patrick, you've been really, really quiet. What did you think of the book?" And I did not like it. And one of the arguments was, well, you have to read book two and three to appreciate book one. Bullshit. you had an entire book. An entire book to make me like it, and well, you failed. So you don't get two more. That's not the way it works. It's like go to any editor in the world and say, "Look, I know that my first book, you may not like it because it's a little too weird. But by the time you publish the second and the third book, I think you'll appreciate the first book." And that editor will be like, "That's not the way it works. You have a chapter." That's what an editor or an agent will say, right? They'll write that red line and say, "This is as far as you got," or "This is as far as I got, and you never hooked me. I went through the entire book. You never hooked me." So you don't get to tell me that I have to read book two and I have to read book three to make book one make sense.
No, understood. One interesting thing that I do know about that book and about Jeff Vandermeer's writing of it was that he did, I think, write the first book. I think he delivered it to his publisher, which is Farrar Straus Giroux. And then I think his editor, after they read it, asked if they might, because he had proposed the trilogy, asked if he might be able to produce the second and third book within a year, so that they could release them all fairly quick succession. So So I wonder if Patrick, if your sort of reaction might be in part a reaction to the way in which it was written.
Well,
you know what I mean?
And what's funny is that was also mentioned to me at the time. And I said, well, wait a minute, that doesn't seem right. Again, you get one book. And again, Jeff took offense to the idea that the three books were coming out at the same time. Because there was also a plan to do an omnibus where you have all three books together in one book. And I'm like,
which is what I have. Right. I actually have the omnibus edition.
And someone said, if you had the omnibus edition and you had to read all three books together, would you have a different feeling? And I'm like, no, now I'm pissed that you're telling me that the plan was to always do an omnibus. So he took offense to that as well. And again, I'm sorry, Jeff, if you're listening. I don't think you are. I think you quit a long time ago with me. But, you know, it was just one of those things where I tried to read this book. I finished the entire book and I'm sitting there scratching my head going, how did this get published? I mean, it really, ouch, to me, it was that difficult. Now, I will say that fans of Jeff Vandermeer, long-term fans of Jeff Vandermeer who love his stuff, rave about that book, and it won a bunch of critical awards. So it could just be, very simply, I'm not the audience for that book. And that's okay too. And that's my point. It's like, it's okay, Jeff. I cannot, you know, I can not be your audience.
No, that's okay. I do wonder though, you know, as you describe this, as we talk about it, and after describing the adaptive, sort of the adaptive and serial box models, I wonder if the way in which it was produced was also, you know, influenced by our kind of, we're heading into this binge kind of new normal, right? The new normal is binge everything. So I wonder if they anticipated that, a desire by readers to just get on to the next thing as quickly as possible, Netflix style. So I wonder if some of your you know, your reaction is based a little bit on that. Like, you know, I watched when Aziz Ansari's Master of None came out last year. I watched it, and I remember the first few episodes. I was underwhelmed, and it actually felt like I was watching someone learning how to make a TV show. And then, you know, 4, 5, 6 episodes in, I really started to love it. But it definitely felt like it was like this arc of a learning arc. And I wonder if some of that is now influencing publishing.
It's entirely possible. However, yeah. I will also say that at the time that the book came out was the ebook explosion. And this was before the publishers got, I think they won a court case or something, or something along the lines of they got to renegotiate all their contracts with Amazon. So this is before that. At this time, Amazon was setting ebook prices and people were buying ebooks like crazy. Yes. And since then, publishers renegotiated all their contracts. They fought for the ability to set higher prices on ebooks, and then ebook sales went down because they set them at a higher price and more print books started to be sold again, right? So they kind of flipped the model. They raised prices on ebooks in order to push the sale of physical books, because that's where their margins are set. That's what their model is all about. So, but at the time, ebooks were selling like crazy and people just wanted more. And they were doing that binging thing. Like they wanted more and more and more and more. And I've called it before, because my agent, I had an agent at the time, he called it the Kevin Hearn model, because the Iron Druid series got to publish like one book a year back to back to back to back, because they had sold, Kevin had written 3 books and they sold 3 books to the publisher, and they decided to push them out one at a time, you know, per year. And there had been a couple of other successes at the time doing the same thing. I don't necessarily think it's connected to the Netflix binge model, but I think it was tied to the ebook binge model that was happening at the time. People were consuming ebooks at a crazy rate, And so the concept of releasing three books in a year, like I believe Michael Sullivan did with the Rhaera Chronicles, and Kevin Hearn did, you know, one year after another with the Iron Druid. There were several different kind of things like that that came out all at once that performed well. So that could have influenced it. But it didn't change my perception of the book. But what was funny is, and you can kind of go back because the SF Signal archives are still out there. And as we're having this conversation and I'm talking about the things I don't like about the first book, all the people on the podcast who loved the first book started to agree with me. And they're like, well, yeah, you're not wrong. Yeah, that wasn't great. Yeah, blah, 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 blah. But their argument was always, you have to read book two. You have to read book three. And then book one becomes better. But I don't see a lot. Like a new TV show comes out. You watch the first episode. You don't like it. You don't watch anymore. You read a book. Yeah. You don't like it. It goes into the bin to get donated to the library, and you don't buy any more.
You know, I hear what you're saying, Patrick, but I think you're right to a certain extent. But with the TV model, maybe this is just me. I feel like people will give TV a couple of episodes.
Now they will.
Unless they hate it. Because I know a lot of times I'll be like, all right, this is a little slow. I like the concept. And especially, I think you've even said this before, like, don't judge a TV show on the pilot.
Yes. And specifically science fiction shows, because they're always trying to figure out who they are and what they're doing.
Yeah, it sometimes takes a few episodes or even like half a season to kind of figure out what it's all about and what the format is and the groove of it. So,
but I will say this, if you go through an entire season and it never finds it and you never like it, you don't go back for more seasons.
Yeah, I think the season model is a good way to put it. And let's face it, it's a lot easier to watch an episode of a TV show than it is to read a whole book. You know, you can watch a couple episodes, and if you're three episodes in and like not digging this, then you can let it go. And that was, you know, 2.5 hours of your life. If you read a book where you're devoted 10 hours to it or something and you hated it, then it's
So I just want to say, Patrick, that I'm not trying to invalidate your love and appreciation for this series. You are not alone. No. There are a lot of people who love this series, enough so that it got sold and is a movie with Natalie Portman that's coming out soon. So if you're into that kind of, you know, it's the new weird, right? It's Jeff Vandenberg. It's the new weird. If that's the kind of thing that you're into and you like that kind of stuff, then by all means, please go out and check out Annihilation and the Southern Reach trilogy. You may enjoy it. I did not.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we know that Patrick Hester is not going to pick that book for his book. But what is Patrick Hester going to pick for his
book? Well, I'm picking a different book. And this might tell you a little bit about me and my style. I'm picking The Long Earth by Terry Pratchett and Stephen Baxter.
Interesting.
Okay.
I just finished it, actually, before I finished it last night. And I loved it. It's very British in its humor and a lot of its concepts, and it's a fun read. And it was something that I finished Persepolis Rising, and I wanted something to kind of cleanse the palate. And after space opera, I always try to, whatever I'm reading, like if I'm reading an epic fantasy, I try to break that with some sort of space opera. If I'm reading space opera, I want to break that with maybe an urban fantasy or something. Like I always want to do something different. Right. And so after Persepolis Rising, which is a very space opera-y kind of thing from James S. I. Corey, I went with this one, which is The Long Earth from Terry Pratchett and Stephen Baxter. Pratchett has a very distinct comedic voice and vision. And Baxter, I think, complements that very well. And it was just a great, great read. And if you want to know the premise of the book, it's Stepping is discovered. And essentially what this is, you have a box that's powered by a potato and you have to build the box yourself. That's a very important component. But if you build this box correctly and you follow all the instructions correctly and you place the potato in the center, you can essentially step from this earth to an alternate earth, either left or right, east or west. And it's about the kind of the exploration of these alternate worlds and the differences between them. And there are also people who are natural steppers who don't need a box and they can just step. And there are, as far as the characters know, there are an infinite number of these alternate worlds. and they can just step between them. And so what happens is there's like a migration of humans from what becomes called the datum, the center Earth, migrating out to these other Earths to kind of get away from other people and to start over and start their own settlements and become what they call pioneers.
Can you choose your destination, or is your destination random?
It's not random, but it's like you can go east one, east two, east three. There's a little switch, and you just have to count how far you're going. But there's an after effect for steppers. Every time you step, you become very nauseated, is that the word? Nauseous. And you end up puking out your guts and feeling sick for 15 minutes to 30 minutes. So that can be dangerous if you step into a world where, say, dinosaurs have evolved over time and never got killed. And you could step into a world where you are quickly eaten.
That sounds wild.
As a prey. So yeah, they just basically, and you can't take anything with you made of iron. So that also limits your ability to, like, you can't take complex tools with you, right? You can't take an axe, you can't take this or that, because these are things that are made and have iron in them. And so one of the sought after things for these new pioneer colonies is to have someone who is a blacksmith, right? And you can step to a world where you know there's iron, because on our Earth, everything is identical for the most part. On our Earth, if you know where there's an iron deposit, you can step to that place in another Earth and start up a forge and a mine and start making your tools and building your community.
Sounds wild.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. I'm going to do a real quick pick. And this is going to be maybe a little bit of a surprise, but I got a new phone because I had an iPhone 5 for the past 3.5 years. And I did not get an iPhone.
What did you get?
I got a Google Pixel 2. I was thinking about this for a while because I was quite an Apple acolyte for many years. And I just started realizing that I don't really use any Apple services anymore. And I use a lot of Google services. So the Google phones were starting to look appealing to me. And I decided to go with the Pixel because it is a Google phone, not just an Android phone, but it is a Google made branded phone. And I was very interested. All the reviews I read was that the operating system is excellent and integrates all your various Google services in. And it was really quite amazing because once you sign in with your Google login, your Gmail login, everything is there for you. So I use Google Play Music. There it is. All my libraries there. My YouTube's there. My Gmail's there. My Google Docs is there. My calendar's there. It's like all right there immediately. So I really like it so far. It's different. They really are trying to make you switch from your iPhone because they made it very easy. Once I turned the phone on, they were like, hey, use this adapter, plug your iPhone into this phone. All your contacts are going to come over now. Cause I did not have to go into the Verizon store at all. It was a beautiful thing. I ordered it online. I got it. I activated it through the website. I put my iPhone up to it and got all the contacts. One of the other things it did, which was awesome, was that it looked at all the apps that you had on your phone and anything that there was an Android equivalent of. They just immediately downloaded it to your phone. So if you have your Audible app and your Amazon Kindle app and whatever else you got, it automatically put that on the new phone as well. So now there's some things that are iOS only that I had to go and find a different app for. But it was a very seamless experience moving over, and I really like it. And I got it because I needed a new phone and I needed a more modern phone and I needed storage. My iPhone was 16 gigabytes. I just couldn't do anything with it.
Some marketing executive at Google is cheering right now. They got you with the ecosystem, the ease of transfer, all of it. Like they just totally got you. That's amazing.
Have you seen the commercials? It's the guy who has gotten every generation of iPhone, and his girlfriend always has the other, like the Google one. And they show him like they fall into the lake and her phone is fine. His phone, he puts in rice. to try to draw the water out, you know, stuff like that. And then she's got the wireless charging and he's sitting there with the dongle with the 10 things trying to, it's really good marketing. Really good.
Yeah. No, they sold me on it because I just, I never thought I was going to ever go away from an iPhone, but then the cost is a thing too. Cause like the new iPhones are like the iPhone 8, like $800. The iPhone X is like 1,000. And, this retail is 650. Google was selling it for 600. Verizon was selling it for 350. Of course, it's still such a pain to deal with Verizon because then you can't just buy it outright. You have to do it by month. So that's annoying. And then they throw a $30 upgrade fee in there. And it's like, man, can't you just be upfront about it? Because it's, you still walk out of it with like a bad taste in your mouth. Like, even though it's a good deal in the end, you're just like, man, why can't you just be cool? Like, can't you be cool about it? Like, why do you got to throw those service charges out and so much? But in the end, from the time I like ordered it to the time I had it set up, it was maybe 2 hours of my life. And I did not have to step in a store because I figured, like, you know what? If I went in a store, I'd probably be in there about that long anyway. And the whole time I'd have to be battling Verizon reps from trying to upsell me to a bigger phone or a case or, you know, whatever, you know, some protection plan that I don't want or, you know, it's, you could do everything online now, everybody. All I had to do was do a little chat with one of the tech support people for about 10 minutes to get it activated properly. And that was it. So it was great. So anyway, it's a good phone. I've only had it for 2 weeks. I'm still learning it, but I like it very much so far. So that's my pick, the Google Pixel 2. Well, we had our main topic and let's get into it anyway, but we ended up having a long discussion. As I said, Patrick Loyer said like, well, you know, what's the format like? And I'm like, oh, we'd go naturally where we went. And we went naturally some places where we weren't expecting, but we were going to talk about the Disney, well, I said Disney Fox merger, but really it's Disney is buying Fox. And there are some specific nerd related things that I would certainly like to get into.
The whole Patrick thing Loyer, is nerd. It's all Marvel, right?
Yeah.
Marvel, Star Wars.
Yeah. So what are your initial thoughts about?
I mean, it, you know, it's funny with something like that because they're talking, you know, Disney and Fox, but obviously the elephant in the room, I think, for the foreseeable future with any kind of strategic move like this is Netflix. It's streaming. It's all kinds of companies really trying to position themselves to get into our homes, get onto our phones, our tablets via streaming. So, you know, I think it was about a year ago or half a year ago, a couple of these players had threatened to remove their content from Netflix. I think Disney was one of them because they see lost revenue. They see their content putting money in Netflix's pockets. So this acquisition, this extraordinary acquisition, it's like $52 billion, is really, I think, about what everyone sees, that everyone wants to be able to get their content where and when they want it. Disney, you know, basically, you know, one of the, they've basically, they own so many of the stories and franchises that we love, but they don't have some of them. You know, they don't have like X-Men, they don't have Fantastic Four, they don't have Deadpool. So those are the things that they can get now. If this deal goes through, if the Justice Department allows them to do this, then they will have you know, sort of ownership of just about every kind of nerdish story that you can think of. So
and any female,
I think it's smart.
And any female xenomorphs born to the xenomorph queen become Disney princesses. In Aliens.
Well, there you go. That's what I was going to say. Thank you for stealing my point. The point that I had thought a lot about with this, and Patrick Loyer brought this up with Netflix, is that Disney announced some time ago that they were going to be starting their own branded streaming channel to compete with Netflix. And that is not supposed to launch until 2020, I believe. And they already have quite an impressive lineup of material, quite a library between all their Disney shows, Disney Channel shows, their Disney movies, the Pixar movies, all the Marvel movies, all the Star Wars movies. So they have quite a catalog already. And I think that is one of the reasons that they were motivated to buy Fox, is because now they have that whole catalog, which can now go onto that channel if they choose. The other wrinkle with that, while we're talking about the streaming channel space, is that Disney already owns ABC, which owned 1/3 of Hulu.
Yes.
And Fox owned another 1/3 of Hulu. So now Disney owns 2/3 of Hulu.
Yes.
So I think what you're going to see, and from what I've seen so far, maybe Patrick Lohier, you can weigh in on this, is that I've sort of heard that they're going to keep Hulu kind of as is, and maybe kind of keep kind of their adult, more adult type programming over there. And the Disney streaming channel is going to be a little more towards family. So I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
I think you're absolutely right about that. I think they've got like a 60%, or they would, if this goes through, they'll get like a 60% ownership stake in Hulu. And, you know, with this, with these acquisitions, their content, the types of content that they now or will own or would own, will be much more diverse when it comes to, I think, family friendliness. So a perfect example is something like, two perfect examples are things like Logan or Deadpool, where, you know, I certainly would not want my my 10 or 8-year-old watching either of those just yet. But those are big successes. So those are, they need channels in order to really be able to share those parts of their catalog. So something like a Hulu, or you know, I don't know what their streaming platform will look like, if it will be similar to Netflix with a, you know, a kids section and a grown-up section, but they really need to keep an eye on how they're going to basically present these different diverse types of content as well, because they've been, for most of Disney's life, they've been almost entirely about kids, but now they're going into a whole new game. So I think you're right on with that.
Well, and Disney, I believe, owned Miramax. So they have made more adult, have had their hand in more adult things, but it just didn't have the Disney brand name on it. They used a different brand name for it. I think it's Miramax. I could have that mistaken with another movie company. So it's not completely uncharted. Now, you brought up Deadpool and you brought up Logan. And Patrick Hester, I wanted your thoughts on this, because I think right now it is going to be in like a weird state of flux, because there are so many X-Men kind of movies that are already in production. You have Deadpool 2, you have the New Mutants movie coming out, you have another X-Men film already in production. So Patrick Hester, what are your thoughts in terms of how they're going to transition / start adding those to the Marvel Cinematic Universe proper?
I don't think that Disney is afraid to simply cancel things. They've done that before. When they bought Star Wars, first thing they did was cancel Clone Wars.
That's true. You're right.
Second thing they did was throw out all the books and say, these are fan fiction now. These are legends. These have nothing to do with the canon. Mm-hmm. So they're not afraid of doing that. And they're not afraid of the backlash, if there mm-hmm. is any. When it comes to the Fantastic Four, they canceled the comic book because right. they were tired of the crappy movies that were being made. And they said, look, we don't have to support these movies anymore. We're just going to cancel the comic book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they're not afraid of any of that. They're currently in production is Dark Phoenix, I believe, mm-hmm. on the X-Men side. I don't believe there's a Fantastic Four movie in production.
No.
There's probably another Spider-Man movie, and there's a Venom movie.
Well, Spider-Man is Sony. That's not Fox.
Oh, that's right. That's right. So those are separate. Okay.
That's got nothing to do with this. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Those are Sony Columbia. Okay. So yes. So the X-Men movies, really, there's Deadpool 2 and there's the Dark Phoenix movie.
There. And yeah. New Mutants. And New Mutants 2 right. is already in production.
And so I think that at least New Mutants and Deadpool 2 are far enough along in production that nothing weird's going to happen. with the Dark Phoenix piece, I don't know what's going to happen. There's, you know, Disney basically went down the road with Marvel of cutting the mutants out of most of what they were doing in favor of Inhumans, because they said, look, you know, since we can't use the mutants, we're just going to use the Inhumans everywhere. And the Inhumans has been a horrible disaster.
Yeah,
just a horrible disaster. So I think to get rid of that will make them very happy. The part that's going to suck in all this is the Netflix world that's kind of been built with the Defenders is most likely going to go away.
That's, probably.
Yeah. Yes, that's painful. I mean,
And even though that means a blessed end to Danny Rand.
Iron Fist on.
It also unfortunately means an end to Luke Cage and to Jessica Jones and Daredevil, which I think were all three very solid shows.
And Punisher, my heart breaks.
Yeah, that was a very decent show as well. It was very intense.
Oh yeah.
And I just don't know. I'm not a fan of what's happening with all of these companies, you know, pulling and basically doing their own thing. The CBS All Access thing is just a ridiculous joke. And, you know, to launch a third network now on a Star Trek franchise, it's like, come on, guys, get over it. Start just no one wants it. Come on.
Patrick Lowy, what are your thoughts about, what do you think is going to happen with those movies that are currently in production? Do you think they're going to, you know, run their course, come out, and then Disney/Marvel will then incorporate them in their own way? Or do you think there'll be kind of a hard reboot where they'll be recasting? Like, keep in mind, you know, Logan was supposed to be Hugh Jackman's last run at playing that character. So do you think they recast Wolverine and it's just like a new universe kind of a thing where they're going to start over? What do you think they're going to do, Patrick?
I really don't know. I mean, obviously, to your point before about they're not afraid to cut things loose. I think that with the Star Wars franchise, they've done a very I think they've put a lot of effort into future-proofing their vision of that, like really. They've put a lot of discipline into where they want it to go. So I imagine that they'll put the same resources and discipline into thinking of the future of all of these properties, you know, of the Marvel properties, all of these different storylines. And I really can't say where they'll head with that. You know, the ones that have made a ton of money, I think they'll likely keep as is. I did not think of the Netflix Marvel shows until you just mentioned that. So that's, like I said, heartbreaking, because that's my favorite, I guess, of the different places that can catch these Marvel heroes. That one to me is the most grown up, the most sort of unexpected, the most mature and innovative. I have a little bit of fatigue with the movie theater Marvel movies, the Iron Mans and the Hulks, in part because they're really more for, I think, a younger audience. Whereas with Jessica Jones, with Punisher, it seems like anything can happen. And I hope that they keep a space for that kind of interpretation.
And they might, but they might push it to Hulu, because that's what they did with Runaways.
And which would be smart. You know, I think that would be smart. Although, again, you know, it's sort of like, does that mean, because I don't have Hulu, you know, so maybe that compels me to get Hulu. I don't know. But I imagine a lot of people would be in the same position of like really having to consider whether they're going to dive into a whole new platform in order to get the content that they want. But again, to your question, I really can't say what they'll do with this stuff. And again, you know, who knows if the Justice Department is going to allow this behemoth this Hulk, for lack of a better word, to come to be, because it's going to be a massive, massive company. You know, this $52 billion thing will be just huge. So the antitrust piece, I'll be intrigued to see how that pans out.
Right. And one of the things, an article I read today, which is really kind of eye-opening and kind of shocking, is they were talking about the release schedule for the spring and the summer, and they're moving some things around. Like, I think they're going to move Deadpool yes. up a couple of weeks, and because within the space of just a couple of weeks, well, I think Black Panther's out in February, but then the Avengers movie is out in May, the Han Solo movie is out in May, and now Deadpool 2 is going to be out in May. So those three movies are going to be within a week of each other. It's going to be like Avengers, so kind of all competing for the same audience, or a very similar audience at least anyway. So that is kind of crazy, and I doubt in the future you will see those kinds of movies all by the same company in that short a space, because they're, I think that's the one thing, complication that they have to deal with right now, is that these now are from the same company, and they don't want to siphon off. Yes, exactly. They would not put Avengers, Han Solo, and that's another whole discussion. It's like, why not push Han Solo? Well, they don't want to push Han Solo back till December now, because there's Mary Poppins, which sounds funny. It's like, that's not this, but it's a big family audience.
But John,
Disney wants to clear the room for that.
John, two of those movies were scheduled the way they were, right? Black Panther and Han Solo were scheduled to be very close together.
I think Black Panther's February, if I'm not mistaken, or March maybe, I'm not sure. But Han Solo is May. The Avengers and Han Solo were going to be close together the whole time, which seems weird that they would want them so close together, but who knows. This is a long topic that we can keep talking about, but maybe we'll have to have Patrick Lohier back on to talk about it some more. Before we get into anything else, I do want to mention again that Patrick Lohier has The False Idols out now, and
actually it's coming out in a few weeks.
Right. What's the release date on that?
Basically, with the cereal box model, False Idols will be available per episode on a weekly basis starting January 31st. So if you go to the cerealbox.com website, you can get the first episode for free, and then every subsequent episode is about, I think, between $1.60 or $1.99. Don't hold me to that. You can also subscribe so that those episodes get delivered to you. So between January 31st and I think the it's early April 11th, episodes will be released weekly that readers will be able to get. And then after that, when we've wrapped all of that up, I think the book will be available also as a paperback, I think in April, that will be published by Adaptive. So that's part of that partnership model that I mentioned earlier. So downloadable episodes starting January 31st, and then a paperback in or around mid-April.
Excellent. Anything else you want to let our listeners know before we, and any convention appearance coming up, any other projects that you'd like our listeners to know about before we wrap it up here?
I've got another book that I'm finishing up that Adaptive Books will be publishing, I think, in late spring. That book is titled titled Radiant Night, and it's just a bizarre, another kind of bizarre fiction. So I'm excited about that. I don't have an exact release date for that, but I'll keep you posted. And just, I guess, a shout out to my family and for their support and for helping me while I was working on False Idols.
Excellent. And if you want to follow Patrick on Twitter, it's Patrick Lohier. So you spell Patrick and then Lohier is spelled Lohier. So you can follow him there on Twitter. And that's his website too, patricklohier.com. For us, once again, if you dig the show and dig chats with folks like Patrick Lohier, consider becoming one of our backers over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. Thanks. And a shout out to the people that already back us. Patrick Hester. What will you leave our listeners with?
I will leave our listeners with the words of the new doctor. Brilliant.
Yeah. All right, Patrick Lohier, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it, and best of luck.
Thank you for having me.
No problem. And everyone, have a great week.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?
I'm the one in the middle.